This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne. We've been looking back on this one-year anniversary of the financial crisis, and this morning we revisit some startling moments on Capitol Hill. The Republican Treasury Secretary went to a Congress controlled by Democrats to plead for hundreds of billions of taxpayer dollars to prop up some of the nation's mightiest financial institutions. Congress complied, but lawmakers also vowed to revamp a regulatory system they said had clearly failed. To date, no such overhaul has occurred. As part of our series on the financial crisis and where it has led, NPR's David Wellna has this report.
By September 18th last year, 3 days had gone by since the Bush administration decided that the giant brokerage firm Lehman Brothers was not too big to fail. Without a government rescue, the firm had collapsed and the Dow had plunged more than 500 points. That morning, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid complained that a growing crisis was not being dealt with openly.
The American people are being kept in the dark as to what's going on. We've only had secret meetings, and I believe it's time the secret meetings ended.
But that evening, there would be one more secret meeting, or at least one that took place behind closed doors. In a dramatic move, then-Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson and Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke went to the Capitol and met in House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's office with top congressional leaders from both parties. Afterward, Paulson publicly flattered his hosts.
I think we saw the best of the United States of America in the Speaker's office tonight.
Paulson did not say what he told the lawmakers, but it was enough to convince House Republican leader John Boehner that the financial system needed a rescue, and fast.
We clearly have an unprecedented crisis in our financial system. And even though we're some 6 weeks away from an election, it's clear that on behalf of the American people, our job is to put our partisan differences aside and to work together to help solve this crisis.
Senate Banking Chairman Christopher Dodd, for his part, appeared deeply shaken.
Put it this way, I've been in the Senate for 28 years, been in Congress 34. There's never been a moment as serious as this one.
What Paulson and Bernanke had asked for was $700 billion to buy up the troubled assets of the nation's financial giants. That weekend, Paulson made clear on Fox News his reluctance in making that request.
I don't like the fact that we have to do this. I hate the fact that we have to do it, but it's better than the alternative. And once we stabilize the markets, we then have to take actions to make sure this doesn't happen again.
This massive bailout is not a solution. It is a financial socialism, and it's un-American.
That's Kentucky Republican Jim Bunning lecturing Paulson a few days later at a Senate Banking Committee hearing. The top Republican on that panel, Alabama's Richard Shelby, also opposed the bank bailout.
I fear that this is not contained, and we will repeat it again if we don't have massive, tough regulatory reform in the next Congress.
2 weeks after the bailout money was requested, it got approved. But that tough regulatory reform is still pending. Here's President Obama speaking to Wall Street investors just 2 days ago.
We intend to pass regulatory reform through Congress. And taken together, we're proposing the most ambitious overhaul of the financial regulatory system since the Great Depression.
House Financial Services Chairman Barney Frank says working out the financial mess has taken so much time that revamping financial regulations has had to wait.
I expect that by the end of the year, we will have passed a whole set of new, very tough regulations.
But the fact that you don't have any changes in those regulations at this point, could it mean that we could have another meltdown as we did a year ago?
No one seriously thinks so. I think, frankly, what you're evincing is the insistence on the media of finding bad news even at any cost. And I have to tell you, I don't know anyone who realistically thinks that in the next month we're going to have this kind of crisis. It isn't there.
But in his drive to overhaul financial regulations, Frank may not be able to count on much support from the top Republican on his panel, Alabama's Spencer Backus.
The obvious lesson of the events of the past 2 years is that we need smarter regulation. Not that we need more regulation.
Senate Banking Chairman Dodd, for his part, is unwilling to commit to completing a financial regulatory overhaul this year.
It's a complicated area. It's much more complicated than health care and much more complicated than energy policy. When you start getting into the areas of rating agencies and derivatives and insurance and systemic risk regulators and the bank rate of the Fed and all these matters and trying to reorganize all of this in a way that hasn't been done since the 1930s is a tremendous challenge. But we're getting close to a good bill, I think.
Ranking Republican Shelby prefers taking things slowly.
We're trying to do something very complex, but to do it right. We should not rush to judgment.
But Harvard Law Professor Elizabeth Warren, who chairs the Congressional Oversight Panel that's to keep track of the bailout, says a financial regulatory overhaul cannot be delayed.
If we don't make changes, the crisis we saw a year ago that brought us to the brink of a Great Depression will return, and the next time we won't go to the brink, we'll go right over the edge.
Warren says the goal for finishing a financial regulatory makeover should be Christmas. David Wellna, NPR News, The Capitol.
All of the health care bills circulating through Congress, including the final one unveiled today, require people to carry health insurance. The bills also include some government subsidies to help them pay for it. The latest bill, long awaited from the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, provides less generous subsidies to keep costs down. As NPR's Scott Horsley reports, the smaller subsidies could make it harder for middle-class families to afford the mandatory insurance.
When Massachusetts overhauled its own health care system 3 years ago, it included a requirement for all residents to carry health insurance, just as Congress is considering now. Massachusetts offered subsidies to help families earning up to 3 times the poverty rate. For Mark Friedman and his family, the newly affordable insurance was a welcome relief.
It was excellent. You know, we paid $330 a month, and my wife and I received very good health insurance for that price.
But after about a year, Friedman, who teaches economics at several colleges around the state, got a raise. And once his income topped about $55,000, he was no longer eligible for the subsidized insurance.
I made a few thousand dollars over the limit. And it's on or off, black or white. You exceed by one penny, and chow chow, you buy your own insurance.
Friedman went shopping for private insurance, but found a comparable policy for his family of three would have cost about $1,500 a month, more than he pays in rent. Even a catastrophic policy would have cost about $1,000 a month, so Friedman wound up doing without.
We're in this situation where the state says, you make too much, you're too rich, we're not giving you anything, no subsidy. But at the same time, there's nothing affordable out there for you, so chew on that.
Tens of thousands of other middle-class residents are in the same boat. Carol Pryor, who's research director for a Boston nonprofit called the Access Project, says many of the remaining uninsured in Massachusetts make too much money to qualify for subsidized insurance, but too little to easily buy it on their own.
There is a gap in the middle, and that is troublesome.
And that gap would likely be even wider under the national health care plan unveiled today by Senator Baucus. Under that plan, a family of four making $66,000 a year could pay as much as $715 a month, even with a government subsidy. Senator Baucus whittled away at the proposed subsidies in the plan in order to lower the overall price tag.
We've done everything imaginable to get the most generous, most affordable coverage that we could within President Obama's target of $900 billion.
Critics complain the Baucus bill would lead to big out-of-pocket expenses for middle-income families. They'd be required to buy insurance or pay a penalty of up to $3,800 a year. In a bid for Republican votes, the Baucus plan does not include a public insurance option, which proponents say would help lower costs. Baucus says he is still committed to providing choice and competition in the insurance market through nonprofit co-ops, if necessary. In Massachusetts, the combination of mandatory insurance and public subsidies has worked. All but about 4% of working-age adults in the state now have insurance. But researcher Pryor says for many middle-income families, affordable coverage is still out of reach.
If a reform plan is implemented, we need to keep monitoring it to see how the affordability levels are really playing out on the ground. It's not enough to just look at the percentage of people who are uninsured, but once they have coverage, we need to look in an ongoing way at how well that coverage is serving them.
Pryor says that's a lesson for members of Congress to keep in mind as they consider overhauling health care nationwide. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
And the masses have been staying away from some theme parks recently. In Orlando, Florida, Universal's Islands of Adventure hopes to lure them back with something new. It's called Harry Potter and the Forbidden Journey, a ride opening next spring. It's part of the Wizarding World of Harry Potter. NPR's Greg Allen reports.
I've never heard or seen anything like this before. I think it's going to be completely unprecedented, and it's just really, really going to be amazing.
No, Emma Watson, who plays Hermione Granger, wasn't at the news conference on Universal's new Harry Potter section. She was there on tape. Tom Felton, who plays Draco Malfoy, did turn up. And it wasn't so much of a news conference as a promotional webcast aimed at building interest in the world's first Harry Potter theme park attractions.
As you enter the Wizarding World, you first come upon Hogsmeade Station.
Using a specially designed for Universal version of Harry Potter's Marauder map, producer Paul Dorio described what visitors will see when they enter the area.
To your left, you pass Zonko's, the joke shop, and Honeydukes, the sweet shop, where you can purchase an array of jokes and gags and sweets, including chocolate frogs and birdie bots.
Universal's news yesterday was that the Wizarding World of Harry Potter will open in Orlando next spring, although that's a pretty vague timetable for families trying to make travel plans. It's reported to be a $200 million-plus project. It will cover 20 acres and will feature three main rides, or attractions, as they call them in the theme park business. Universal creative president Mark Woodbury says fans will be able to visit the shops, walk the streets, and see the scenes created by J.K. Rowling and made iconic in the Harry Potter movies. He calls it an authentic, immersive environment.
And that extends all the way through Hogsmeade with the three broomsticks and Ollivanders and the Hogshead Pub. You know, really go into these iconographic moments in the movie and turn them into real experiences. That's really the great challenge for us.
To help ensure that authenticity, the art director for the theme park is Alan Gilmore. He's also the art director for the Harry Potter films. He believes the most impressive part of the Wizarding World will be Harry's school, Hogwarts.
It's going to be the Parthenon of Orlando, I think. It'll be the great big temple which people want to come and visit. It's going to be a real edifice, aged to look like it's been there a thousand years. It'll be an extremely different kind of castle to the Disney castle. It'll be a much more European, very real, based in fact.
Keeping up with Universal, Disney just announced plans to rework the Magic Kingdom in Orlando. Robert Niles, founder and editor of the website ThemeParkInsider.com, says Disney is adding a Little Mermaid attraction and building areas that will focus on heroines like Cinderella and Sleeping Beauty.
It doesn't have quite the cross-generational appeal that Harry Potter does, but Disney princesses are an extremely powerful franchise with a lot of fans, and Disney connects with a lot of people, and I think it's going to be quite successful for them once it's open.
That won't be until 2013, which means in Orlando, next year could belong to Universal and its main attraction, Harry Potter and the Forbidden Journey. The company won't say much about the ride, except that it will sweep visitors along a journey that captures experiences from the books and films. Niles says it's expected to be an innovative ride that's already created a fair amount of industry buzz.
It is codenamed within the development community as Project Strong Arm, because they are using robot arms. If you've ever seen pictures of assembly line where they have those robots arms coming in and fixing the cars, well, just bolt a row of four seats to the edge of one of those, and you've got these robot arms which are going to be placed on an elevated track going through the Hogwarts castle.
For Universal, the opening of the Harry Potter section next spring comes at a good time. The recession has been tough on theme parks, and Harry Potter is expected to help boost attendance. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
Fred Stocking died recently. Most of you are probably wondering, who is Fred Stocking? Well, at Williams College in Massachusetts, he was loved by students for over 40 years, students including NPR's Barbara Bradley Haggerty.
I remember sitting in Shakespeare class, basking in my good luck. The wait list was nearly 100 people, but here I was, a new student at Williams College, watching the legendary Fred Stocking in action. Dr. Stocking was a year shy of retirement, lean and meticulous, with a bow tie and thick white hair. He lived Shakespeare, doting on Puck, thundering through Hamlet, and lifting our gaze from the crass pursuit of A's to the beauty of weathered truths. He encouraged me to make writing my career and then unwittingly shaped that career. It happened when I asked him a random question. How do you determine a student's grade? Well, he said, I add up the grades for the essays, the quizzes, the midterm, and the final. I average them out. Then I consult my stomach. Consult my stomach. No three words have influenced or haunted me more. As a reporter, I try to apply Dr. Stocking's stomach test. Is the story I'm telling not just accurate, but honest? I've failed more times than I like, but that standard has marked the north on my compass for the past quarter century. I lost touch with Dr. Stocking for 20 years, but 8 years ago we began exchanging letters every few months. So when I was invited to give a talk for our 25th reunion 3 years ago, I asked my 91-year-old former professor to introduce me. It was a rainy afternoon. The auditorium was packed. The crowd hushed as Fred Stocking walked tentatively across the stage, clutched the podium, and leaned into the microphone.
My name is Fred Stocking.
It was like a schmaltzy Disney movie. The place went wild.
Thank you very much. You've already guessed that I'm retired and a one-time professor of English.
Afterwards, dozens of middle-aged alums, now doctors, economists, and lawyers, lined up to shake Fred's hand. You were my favorite professor, one would say. Another, you made me care about ideas. As for me, Fred's letters became a roadmap for growing old well. He began painting at 80, taking lessons every Tuesday. At 91, he played Gonzalo in The Tempest at the community theater. When his body began to fail, he watched the process with a sort of bemused attachment. At his 94th birthday party, Fred demonstrated his new motorized stair chair lift by waving like the Queen as he purred up and down the stairs. And later, he performed his favorite Broadway song. As Fred's body shut down, he leaned all the more on his mind. It was a sort of tit-for-tat with age. You take away my driver's license, I'll read the new biography of Shakespeare. You dim my vision, I'll listen to books on tape. When I sent him an early draft of my book, he sent back a 7-page critique, musing on the limits of scientific inquiry, the flaws of religious doctrine, and the nature of death. Fred approached his own death clinically. I can accept God as an idea, but not as a fact, he wrote, and he was even more skeptical of the afterlife. In early July, I flew up to Williamstown, Massachusetts, for what I knew would be my final visit. Fred lay on his bed, as faded as his sheets. He said he wasn't sad about dying. I asked him if he thought that his consciousness might survive death. I thought, with death around the corner, he might have warmed up to the afterlife. He looked at me keenly, as if to say, I may have grown old, but I haven't gone soft. What's wrong with mystery? He asked. Then he cleared his throat. It's been a privilege knowing you, he said, and I burst into tears. Fred patted my hand. I'll live on in your memory, he said. It's the best kind of immortality.
NPR's Barbara Bradley Haggerty, her college professor Fred Stocking, died in July. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
In Russia, you can learn something about consumer attitudes, at least among the rich, by looking at the road. Car sales are down by 50% this year, but you will see more and more Hummers. Peter Van Dyke reports from Moscow.
Alexei Birukov wears a smart suit and works for a Western company in an ultra-modern Moscow office. But at the weekend, everything changes.
I'm driving a boring Volvo during weekdays, and then when the weekend is coming, I change my lifestyle. It's like, you know, when you come home, you take the tie off, and then you breathe. It's a freedom.
Birukov is one of the founders of the Russian Hummer Club, which has some 800 members.
It's a feeling of the freedom which gives the car. Americans, as well as Russians, we all like a freedom. And this car gives you the feeling of the freedom because you can go deeper into the forest, you can afford to drive it off-road across the field or the places where normal or any other car probably would stop.
But the Hummer's appeal is not just off-road. Birukov says Russia's notoriously bad drivers and roads, on which 30,000 people die each year, make another strong case for buying a Hummer.
The condition of the roads, which we all used to complain about, and also the style people are driving in Moscow and crowded cities like Moscow, gives you some preferences when you're driving Hummer. And I think that's suitable car for Russia, maybe except the amount of gasoline it takes.
So in a country where the average monthly wage is $600 and gas costs $2.60 a gallon, the average Russian isn't in the market for a Hummer. Yuri Mironov, a salesman at Auto Center City in Moscow, says prices start at $40,000 for an H3, going up to around $80,000 for an H2.
The Russian buyer, if you take the H2, the biggest car, is a man over 30 with a high income. If you take the H3, more affordably priced, you can talk of younger people, 25 years old, but as a rule, men.
Mironov says it doesn't take much sales patter to sell his products. His last customer just walked in and bought one, and, like most customers, he paid in cash.
Of course, as a rule, people who buy Hummers know what they want because there's no equivalent to a Hummer. All that remains is to pick a dealer.
Hummers have been built in Russia's Kaliningrad region since 2004, but sales really took off this year when almost every other brand was tanking. Andrei Kolosov is the marketing director for GM Russia.
Product availability played a good role. We had product on the ground. We managed to keep very attractive, but at the same time, very market-oriented prices.
But Kolosov says the vehicle's popularity is not about lower prices. He says the Hummer is big and brash and suits today's Russia.
I think there is not that strong anti-fuel gazelers mood in society. And at the same time, there are a lot of people who would like to display it, to show themselves.
So far, sales have doubled year on year to more than 900 vehicles, twice as many as the rest of Europe combined. But Yelena Sakhnova, an automobile sector analyst at VTB Capital, doubts those figures are sustainable.
I don't think that we will continue to see very significant growth, because still Hummer is a very specific vehicle. Yes, probably there is some unsatisfied demand, but once it is over, we will not see a significant growth.
But that unsatisfied demand, in both Russia and China, is big enough for a Chinese company to want to buy the Hummer brand from GM. Reports say negotiations on a sale are well advanced. For NPR News, I'm Peter Van Dyke in Moscow.
And the masses have been staying away from some theme parks recently. In Orlando, Florida, Universal's Islands of Adventure hopes to lure them back with something new. It's called Harry Potter and the Forbidden Journey, a ride opening next spring. It's part of the Wizarding World of Harry Potter. NPR's Greg Allen reports.
I've never heard or seen anything like this before. I think it's going to be completely unprecedented, and it's just really... really going to be amazing.
No, Emma Watson, who plays Hermione Granger, wasn't at the news conference on Universal's new Harry Potter section. She was there on tape. Tom Felton, who plays Draco Malfoy, did turn up. And it wasn't so much of a news conference as a promotional webcast aimed at building interest in the world's first Harry Potter theme park attractions.
As you enter the Wizarding World, you first come upon Hogsmeade Station.
Using a specially designed for Universal version of Harry Potter's Marauder map, producer Paul Dorio described what visitors will see when they enter the area.
To your left, you pass Zonko's, the joke shop, and Honeydukes, the sweet shop, where you can purchase an array of jokes and gags and sweets, including chocolate frogs and birdie bots.
Universal's news yesterday was that the Wizarding World of Harry Potter will open in Orlando next spring, although that's a pretty vague timetable for families trying to make travel plans. It's reported to be a $200 million-plus project. It will cover 20 acres and will feature three main rides, or attractions, as they call them in the theme park business. Universal creative president Mark Woodbury says fans will be able to visit the shops, walk the streets, and and see the scenes created by J.K. Rowling and made iconic in the Harry Potter movies. He calls it an authentic, immersive environment.
And that extends all the way through Hogsmeade with the Three Broomsticks and Ollivanders and the Hogshead Pub. You know, really go into these iconographic moments in the movie and turn them into real experiences. That's really the great challenge for us.
To help ensure that authenticity, the art director for the theme park is Alan Gilmore. He's also the art director for the Harry Potter films. He believes the most impressive part of the Wizarding World will be Harry's school, Hogwarts.
It's going to be the Parthenon of Orlando, I think. It'll be the great big temple which people want to come and visit. It's going to be a real edifice, aged to look like it's been there a thousand years. It'll be an extremely different kind of castle to the Disney castle. It'll be a much more European, very real, based in fact.
Keeping up with Universal, Disney just announced plans to rework the Magic Kingdom in Orlando. Robert Niles, founder and editor of the website ThemeParkInsider.com, says Disney is adding a Little Mermaid attraction and building areas that will focus on heroines like Cinderella and Sleeping Beauty.
It doesn't have quite the cross-generational appeal that Harry Potter does, but Disney princesses are an extremely powerful franchise with a lot of fans, and Disney connects with a lot of people, and I think it's going to be quite successful for them once it's open.
That won't be until 2013, which means in Orlando, next year could belong to Universal and its main attraction, Harry Potter and the Forbidden Journey. The company won't say much about the ride, except that it will sweep visitors along a journey that captures experiences from the books and films. Niles says it's expected to be an innovative ride that's already created a fair amount of industry buzz.
It is codenamed within the development community as Project Strong Arm, because they are using robot arms. If you've ever seen pictures of assembly line when they have those robots arms coming in and fixing the cars, well, just bolt a row of four seats to the edge of one of those, and you've got these robot arms which are going to be placed on an elevated track going through the Hogwarts castle.
For Universal, the opening of the Harry Potter section next spring comes at a good time. The recession has been tough on theme parks, and Harry Potter is expected to help boost attendance. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.